Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when live and on the air.
That introduction is compliments of Rachel and Michael from Trinity House Entertainment.inc. They created that for me for MJ Network. And yeah, we are live on the air, as they said it, with the author of The Russian Resurgence. And I'm going to be typing his review in today. I'm posting it. And Alan Topol is here. Hi, how you doing?
Hi, Fran. So happy to be with you. I always love talking with you. We have these great chats. So delighted to be here. Thanks very much for having me. Mm-hmm.
So what made you decide on the Hungarian Revolution for this particular one? Why Hungary and Russia?
Well, it's interesting because mine is a contemporary novel. It takes place at the present time, but it weaves into the background the Hungarian Revolution of 1956. And the reason I decided to weave that into the background is I've always been very intrigued by what happened in Hungary in 1956. It was the height of the Cold War. It was the United States against Russia. We had been urging the Hungarians to revolt. Eisenhower was president at the time. John Foster Dulles was Secretary of State. And at long last, there was a spontaneous Hungarian uprising that was doing enormous damage to the Soviet Union and threatened to destroy the entire Russian Soviet Union. But the United States refused to intervene, refused to help the people who were uprising, and of course the Russians brutally quashed the revolution. And that stuck with me for all those many years because Hungary was a linchpin of what Russia was doing. Now fast forward to the present time where my novel takes place. And suddenly under Putin, Russia is making an effort to reestablish the control over much of Europe. They've moved into the Ukraine. They're starting to make alliances with Hungary and other countries. And it looks as if the Russians are intent, if they can, of recreating their old Soviet empire and restarting the Cold War with the U.S., which makes Hungary a linchpin. And suddenly I'm thinking, my goodness, I could work this historical information into a contemporary novel, a Cold War novel that fits new Cold War, that fits the U.S. against Russia. So it was a question of working in this historical information, and it's also timely because the new Hungarian Prime Minister Orban is an absolute horror, and so there's action going on in Hungary. So those are the factors that led me to weave in 1956 into this contemporary novel.
Yeah, I learned a lot reading this, let me tell you. So the Russian President Kuznetsov, is he modeled after Putin? Because Putin's horrible too.
Well, you know, that's funny because it is horrible. And my Russian president in my novel does seem like Putin. But I just want to say I got there first because I had my Russian president Kuznetsov has appeared in two other of my prior novels. And I like to tell people that he was behaving the way Putin's now behaving before Putin started doing it. Now, I'm not suggesting that Putin read my books and said, I'm going to behave the way President Kuznetsov behaves in Alan Topol's novels. However, there is a great distinct similarity between the way they're doing, because Putin, particularly with his move into take over part of the Ukraine, is he's exactly trying to do what Kuznov's trying to do in my book. And so I really thought the similarities to contemporary time is what gives this novel really kind of a lot of timeliness, and it really makes it very, very relevant to what's happening. But as you know, because we've done a lot of these, Fran, together, mm-hmm. is I'm interested in story primarily, and of course, and the history and the current events are background, but I think they particularly come together in this book, Russian Resurgence.
Yeah, they do. This is really like kept me on my toes. So you start this book off with, very interesting, 12-year-old Nicholas. So how did you decide to start that particular scene with one of my favorite characters in this book, Nicholas?
Well, okay, so this is kind of interesting, Fran, because what, as you point out, and for your listeners and readers and potential readers, yes, it's a book about Hungary and Russia and all those things, but it starts off with a 12-year-old boy named mm-hmm. Nicholas, who lives in Potomac, Maryland, a suburb of Washington, lives with his grandparents because his parents died mysteriously a year before, and he, at the beginning of the book, and the kid loves baseball, that becomes relevant,
yeah.
He plays baseball, he's a star, he loves baseball, and he also, at the beginning of the book, his grandparents' house is caught on fire, is on fire, and he has his grandfather's ordered him, if anything like this happens, you run and run like hell, and that's how the book begins. Now, why the kid and the 12-year-old? Because these family things, I'm at the point in life where I have a number of grandchildren, and I have a grandchild now. Actually, I have three grandsons. One's 15, one's 14, and one's 13. And I watched these kids growing up, and I sort of saw these kids. So I had a pretty good idea of how a 12-year-old would operate now. And so when this kid does some things, he gets on an airplane, and he flies to Paris himself. And, you know, when my editor was looking at the book, she said, she's a young woman, just a couple years out of college and, you know, creative writing and all that. And she says, gee, I'm not sure a 12-year-old would be able to do this. And then I say, well, wait a minute. I have these grandsons. I know what my grandsons could do. These kids could do that. And he's a very resourceful, bright kid, energetic, who's had a tremendous blow in his life. And yet he sort of recoups and gets himself together and goes off and develops the beginning of this plot. So I really kind of loved how Nicholas, the character, and how he operates. And I showed it to one of my grandsons, and I said, I want you to read this first section. And do you think, is this okay? And kids sort of mesmerized with the story. So I loved it, but I really like doing it because if you can bring children into a book, I think it sort of adds to the story, enhances the reading. And I don't mean just having a child who's kidnapped. That's not, you know, that's sort of a lot of people mm-hmm. do that in books, but I don't do that. We don't go in for that. But here he's really, I'm glad you liked him because he became my favorite too as I went through the book, because he's a resourceful kid thrown into sort of a strange world with strange people. His whole world has disintegrated at the beginning of the book, and yet he doesn't want to, you know, just end up throwing himself down in a hole and just trying to go silent. But so he's a good kid, and I like him, and I'm glad you liked him. That's terrific, Fran.
Yeah, I liked him. My nephew is 18. He turned 18. I forgot. Happy birthday, Jake. He turned 18 last week. I can't believe my little guy. And he's a baseball player.
Okay, so he's a baseball player too, so you could relate to that. I had actually one of my brothers was a little league baseball player, and so I could pick up the baseball player stuff for that.
Yeah.
But this kid has had, even before the book, you were asking about the backstory. He has a kind of intriguing backstory because a year before the novel begins, his parents, both his mother and his father, died in a mysterious boating accident on Chesapeake Bay. And the investigators or the Coast Guard, nobody was able to figure out, you know, what happened, why they ended up drowning that day, and the boat went down. And so there are suggestions in the book, and I'm not going to give anything away, is was this foul play? Was this part of a Russian vendetta of the family? And so our boy Nicholas, after his parents are died a year before the book starts, he ends up moving in with his grandparents. And his grandfather has had a very, very fascinating history, but I'm going to hold that till you talk about the grandfather. But at any rate, so that's how I ended up with Nicholas, and I really liked that kid a lot.
No, I like that too. So, is the current political situation in Hungary similar to that in the Russian resurgence? So I don't think a lot of people know, even focus on Hungary, mostly on Russia.
Right. Yep. It absolutely does. It absolutely is similar in this respect. For those of you who follow it or haven't, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, Hungary re-elected its government, and the prime minister is the same, Orbán. Orbán has drawn Hungary very much to the right. He's a very, very authoritarian figure, and he is moving the country to the right. He's moving it, it's anti-immigrant. He's moving it away from the West, away from participation with Germany, France, and England, and EU matters, away from alliance with the U.S. He's moving it much more toward Russia. And I have to confess, I did model my Hungarian prime minister after Orbán. So that's not a coincidence. That's me modeling my character in part after Orbán, because like Orbán, my Hungarian prime minister started out as a liberal or progressive on the left. He was a democratic figure. He wanted to enhance and encourage democracy within Hungary. And then he wanted to increase his power and grasp more and more power. And as he did, he realized, much like Orbán, that the way to increase his power is by taking away the center, moving gradually to the right, and at each stage taking away the center and thereby quelling his political opposition. This is what my fictional Hungarian prime minister did. This is what Orbán has done. And now Orbán is also turning toward Russia. My Hungarian prime minister is turning toward Russia. My Hungarian prime minister is also corrupt in finance matters. The corruption hasn't come out about Orbán, so in that sense, perhaps there's a difference there. But I did want to, in a sense, wake up people and give a little bit of an education about what's happening in Hungary, because after all, Hungary's a very pivotal country, always has been. It's right at the center of Central Europe, and people always refer to it as Eastern Europe, but in the case of Hungary, it's not Eastern Europe, it's very much Central Europe, and it's a central part of what's happening in Europe, and that's a very much of a changing landscape. So I loved being able to write about that. I also visited there several times and just had fascinating visits in that country.
Well, I have another question, and
I learned about the Gorbachev and the Prime Minister of.
So anyhow, that's what I did, Fran. You still there, Fran?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm fluctuating between regular phone and speakerphone, so I don't have to put the phone in my face.
Okay, good.
Explain the friendship pact that Kossoff wanted him to sign, wanted the Hungarian Prime Minister to sign, and what was his motive behind that? That really got me and go like, oh, my God, that would happen in real life probably?
Oh, yeah, it would be because the Russian my Russian president, Kuznov, decides that the way to recreate the Soviet Empire is by, first of all, getting an alliance with Hungary, which is called a friendship pact, and then using that as the device to move Russian troops into Hungary. Because my president, Kuznov, this is a different time than 1945. In 1945, the war was ending. There was chaos in Europe. It was easy for the Russian Red Army to move into Hungary and Central Europe and to take over Hungary. But it's not 1945 now. It's a much different time. And I didn't want to have Russia simply invading these European countries, at least not yet. But I wanted them to establish, Kuznov, to establish a beachhead, so to think, to get a way to get his troops into Hungary so he could use that as the basis for expanding the Soviet Empire, the Russian Empire in Central Europe. And that's why I came up with the idea of this friendship pact, because I thought it could work, because the Russians could do something for Hungary. They agree to supply Hungary with construct nuclear power plants, which will permit Hungary to generate all of its electricity, because Hungary doesn't have oil or gas. And in return, the Hungarians will allow the Russians, under this friendship pact, to station their troops in Hungary. Now, the deal was moving along fine, except at one point, the Hungarian prime minister decided that, hey, there was nothing in it yet for him. He wanted a personal payoff. He wanted a bribe. And so Kuznov, the Russian president, agreed to pay him the bribe in order to get him to go along with this friendship pact. But I thought the friendship pact was sort of a neat way to get the it's a kind of a Trojan horse to let the Russian troops come into Hungary and thereby gain a foothold in Eastern Europe or Central Europe. So that was kind of the basis for the friendship pact. But as you say, Fran, I mean, that could happen in real life. I mean, it could happen today or tomorrow. It wouldn't surprise me to pick up the newspaper and read Orbán signs agreement with Putin and to have the two of them shaking hands, much as we have the ceremony at the end of my novel. I think that's absolutely realistic in terms of what's happening now.
Oh, without a doubt. And somebody else is shaking hands with Putin, too. I don't know about that anymore. So let's go back to my guy, Nicholas. And he's taking the train to Paris, and he's supposed to meet this Emma. And what happens when he gets there?
Right, exactly.
It changes everything
so
for him.
Yeah, so let's sort of set the stage for our readers. Here our boy, our 12-year-old Nicholas, has gotten on an airplane after run away from the house that's on fire, gotten himself out to Dulles Airport, and gotten himself onto a plane to Paris, where his grandfather's instructions were, call Emma, and Emma will tell you what to do. So he calls Emma. Emma says, come to Paris. I'll get you on an airplane. She gets him on an airplane. He comes to Paris, and Emma is his one hope at this point. He has nobody in the U.S. He's going to Emma, and he arrives at Emma's house, and he's in a taxi. He's falling asleep. He's been up all night. the taxi arrives and gets to Emma's house, and Nicholas then sees, as he gets out of the cab, sees lots of police in Paris around Emma's house. And to his horror, he sees that a dead body is being brought out of the house, and he hears newspaper woman who speaks English talking, and she says that Emma is dead, that Emma's been murdered. And so here, let's imagine this 12-year-old kid. He ran away from his house. The house he lived in, grandparents' house, was burned down, got on an airplane, traveling himself, gets to Paris. Emma was supposed to be at the airport. She wasn't there. He takes a cab, gets to her house, finds out she's dead. He has nobody in the world. He's in a strange country. He's in a strange city. And this is too much for Nicholas. He may have been smart, resourceful, and everything. This is too much for Nicholas. And at this point, he is so traumatized by all of this that he loses his voice. He can't speak. He's absolutely traumatized by these events. And this is kind of the beginning of the story that gets the action going and sort of puts Nicholas at the heart of the book. And here is this kid. He's come. Here's his relationship with Emma severed. He has nobody or anything, and he's in a strange country. You've got to feel sorry for this kid. I mean, you really do at this point in the book.
So how come he attacked? Well, I like him, and he should come back again someday.
Who should come back? Nicholas. Okay.
Nicholas meets Elizabeth, and how does he realize that he could trust her? How does he realize he could trust Elizabeth Crowder? Well, we've got to get to the main character, her and my other guy, Craig Page. So how does he come to trust her, all of a stranger, out of nowhere?
Well, what happens is at the scene of the murder, of Emma's murder in Paris, which, by the way, takes place, for those of your listeners and readers, the house is in Place de Vosges, which is a wonderful, beautiful little square in Paris. It's the square on which Victor Hugo's house was located and is now a museum on that particular square, which is why I picked that square. So it has some literary significance. But at any rate, there are a lot of press people milling around, which they always do with the police, and only one of them can speak English, and she's a woman in her 30s, who's an attractive woman, seems like a nice person, and she then, Nicholas then, seeks her out, in part because she's the only one that could speak English, and he doesn't speak any French, and so he has to trust her. He doesn't know if he can trust her, but she seems very kind to him. In their initial discussions, when she talks to him and approaches him, she seems kind, but he almost has no choice because his alternative would be to go with the French police. And he's thinking about, should he go with the French police? And the problem is his grandfather, who had very serious past history with authorities and police in Hungary and armies. His grandfather taught him you can never trust the police or the military, because that was his grandfather's upbringing. So he thinks about going to the police, and then he recalls what his grandfather said, you can't trust the police. So he has nobody else, literally nobody else. And here's this woman who looks kind, sounds kind, and can speak English. And so he ends up willing to go to her, and in the hope that she will help him. And then in terms of their relationship, and as you know from other Elizabeth Crowder books and Greg Page books, is Elizabeth is also, she's a baseball player as well. Elizabeth, mm-hmm. when she went to high school and went to college, she pitched on the boys' baseball team. So they share this interest in baseball. And even now, she's with a group of Americans who play baseball in a Paris park every Sunday during the summer. So they share this sort of relationship and love of baseball. And once he knows that Elizabeth has this great interest in baseball too, this solidifies their personal relationship. But at the end of the day, in terms of your question, Fran, she was the only game in town for him. I mean, he couldn't trust the police. He had nobody else. Nobody else spoke English. And so he decides to take a chance with Elizabeth, which, of course, turns out very, very fortunate for our boy Nicholas.
Well, he was lucky he's a good judge of character. Otherwise, I'd hate to see what would happen. So his grandfather is Peter Toth. But how does Craig Page feel about this when he finds out that Elizabeth has now with this young boy? And what do they do to keep him safe? Because they can't allow anybody to know he's there.
That's right. And it's interesting because this whole child thing adds a dynamic to the Craig and Elizabeth relationship. They've been together for several books, 5 or 6 books, as you know, because you've read them all and we've talked to all of them about it. And they are romantically involved. They're living together. They're not married, although occasionally there are discussions about marriage. They don't have any children. And what happens is Craig comes home from another event that he's involved in, which ties into the plot, another murder which he saw. But he comes home, and suddenly this kid is in his house. And they then have the issue of how are they going to protect this kid? And because they know he's at risk, he's in danger, because whoever quickly Elizabeth deduces that somebody set the house on fire. And so this fire in his grandparents' house was not an accident. And I don't want to give away anything in the story, but it's believed that his grandparents were killed. So somebody did this, and so the boy has to be at risk themselves. And so a primary objective for Craig and Elizabeth is, how do we protect Nicholas? And Elizabeth has a relationship with somebody who runs a clinic for children who have emotional and traumatic problems. And that ends up helping in part to protect Nicholas. But Nicholas, we're not sending him off to some home. Nicholas stays very much into the action as the book proceeds, and including one baseball game where Elizabeth, recognizing there's a risk to Nicholas, and Craig is practically ballistic over it, but Elizabeth insists that Craig should come out on that Nicholas should come out on Sunday and be able to play baseball with her team. It's an adult team, but Nicholas is very good. He plays second base, and so that's how it kind of works. But they're always mindful of the risk to Nicholas that something could happen to him. So that's kind of how that unfolds.
It's kind of like she becomes very attached to him. And in some respects that's good, and in some respects it's not good. But we're going to say why. So tell us, why does Craig undertake a risky, almost reckless trip to Russia? And how does this impact his relationship with Elizabeth? She has a fit.
She does have a fit, because what happens as this story and is evolving with Nicholas, who set the house on fire, who killed Emma, that's something mm-hmm. that Elizabeth is initially investigating on her own, and Craig is not a part of it. But meantime, Craig has his own action going on. When he was out running in the beginning, at the same time that Elizabeth had her initial meeting with Nicholas, Craig noticed a body being pulled from the Seine River, and a dead body. And that body is the body of a Mossad agent who Craig knew from his CIA days and with whom he worked together. So Craig then goes to Israel for the man's funeral, the Mossad agent's funeral. Amos is his name, or Amos if you prefer. And he goes to Israel for the funeral, and then he comes back and becomes determined to find out who killed Amos. And it's in his effort to find out who killed Amos that Craig undertakes a trip to Russia, and particularly to Grozny, which is a part of Russia. It's a sort of a renegade province in southern Russia, because Craig is on the search for a terrorist who he believes may have been responsible for the murder of Amos. Now, it sounds like I have two different novels and two different stories going on, but they will merge. Believe me, the two stories will merge, what Craig's doing in Russia and what happens to Nicholas. But at any rate, in his search for this terrorist from Grozny, is Craig then decides he's going to Russia. And the risks of that trip are great, and that's what, as you say, really throws Elizabeth into a tizzy. I mean, she's furious at him. Craig, as a character, is constantly undertaking very bold and risky actions. That's part of how Craig operates. But even for Craig, this one is particularly risky. Now, how did I arrive? It's interesting, because Grozny, and having my terrorist from Grozny, is I always try to find different parts of the world to introduce readers to, so they'll maybe learn a little something about a different part of the world, a different conflict, at the same time they're being entertained by the story. And Grozny has fascinated me because it's been a renegade Russian province since the time of Peter the Great. The Russian rulers have periodically tried to destroy or annihilate Grozny, and the Groznyans have always fought back, and they've had this violent relationship with Moscow. And I wanted to introduce this Russian-Grozny conflict to the readers, and it made sense to have this terrorist from Grozny. So Craig goes off at great risk to himself to Grozny, a part of Russia, to find this terrorist. And of course, very much our Russian president, Kuznov, gets on Craig's trail, and he knows what Craig's doing. And so Craig then ends up pitting his mind against Kuznov, and the two of them are doing battle with each other mentally, if not physically, at this point in the novel.
I wasn't sure who was going to win the battle after a while, because this guy's really crazy. He takes care of people in three different ways. He makes them disappear, he kills them, or they just, you don't want to know. This guy's crazy. Sounds like real life. So she, Elizabeth, is her friend. Emma's her friend. So why does she want to find out who killed her? And how does this intertwine with Nicholas's grandfather? Then we're going to get to the nitty-gritty.
I have some surprises in this book that I don't want to give away to your listeners about Emma. So let me just put it to this way. Elizabeth decides that there must be a relationship between the fire in Potomac, Maryland, and what happened to Emma. And that's what she is determined to find out, what it was and who was responsible. And along the way, Elizabeth discovers what the history and background was of Nicholas' grandfather, Peter. And Peter Toth had a fascinating background, because When Peter was a young boy at the time of the 1956 Hungarian uprising, and Peter's father was a leader in the uprising and was a diplomat, and he was going to the United States to argue the case of the freedom fighters before the UN. And he wanted his wife, that's Peter's mother, and Peter to come with him. But at the last minute, something happens disclosed in the story, why Peter's mother doesn't come and why Peter then stays behind with his mother. The father then goes to New York, is of course unsuccessful at the UN, but cannot get back to Hungary. And Peter's mother and Peter are trapped, and a Russian colonel moves into their house, makes Peter's mother his love slave, and treats Peter horribly. So much so, in one incident, he brands a hammer and sickle on the boy's arm so that he will know that he is responsible to the Soviet Union and not to any independent Hungary. And so that's Peter's uprising. Peter then becomes a successful hockey player on the Hungarian team, and that provides a vehicle for him to defect to the U.S. But Peter has a bitter and horrible upbringing, and the Peter's story becomes the vehicle for an Elizabeth's investigation of that story, for me to bring out what happened in 1956. And, you know, this is tricky, Fran, and we've talked about this before, is it's important sometimes in books to bring out a historical backstory. This is way back, because it's a 2018 novel, but the backstory or some of the historical backstories from 1956. And the question is, how do you do that and yet not disturb the story? You don't want to slow the story down. You can't have too much of the backstory or it takes away from the current story. And that was the hardest part I had of writing Russian Resurgence, of making sure that the backstory, though critical to understanding Peter, became a small part of the story and didn't dominate, and didn't take away from the main story. That was the hardest part of writing this novel, and I think it worked, but it was tricky along the way.
Well, some of those surprises were even trickier, but that's just people not to know, saying anything.
Right.
Okay, so we've got somebody that aggravated my liver after a while. That's President Wirth. And he becomes involved in Peter and the Mossad agent, Amos. And he doesn't want anybody to, he just sort of, you know, puts the restraints on people. How come? He doesn't really let Craig do what he wants to do. And, of course, I love the FBI director, Betty. She's great, too. So how come he doesn't allow people to really do their jobs? He reminds me of somebody else in the news lately.
Well, he doesn't, because he doesn't want to have any conflicts if he can avoid it with the Russians or the Hungarians. He doesn't want to confront the Russian president. He doesn't want to, or the Hungarian, he doesn't want to face the fact that the Russian president he's dealing with and the Hungarian prime minister are both horrors, and they will only be stopped by direct, powerful intervention by the U.S. He doesn't want to do this. He shies away from if he can avoid it at all, from the hard political decisions that will involve use of American force. And Craig is urging him to take strong action. I mean, at one point, a key terrorist is absolutely standing out in the open and could be killed immediately by a drone and the U.S. president refuses to give the order. Wow, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? So at any rate, Craig has to, as you said, with Elizabeth and aided by Nicholas, Craig has to do his own thing, and he's used to doing his own thing. He's clashed with this president before, but it is frustrating for Craig that he can't get the U.S. president to do what is perfectly appropriate and required by the situation. So it is unfortunate, and if anybody sees any similarities to political situations in our lifetime, well, there they are. Right, Fran?
You got it. Yeah, the Omar's a nasty man. But before I forget, on Thursday, I am excited to have KJ Howe, who runs the PhilaFest, Skyjack. On next week, on Tuesday, New York Times author R.Z. Belsky, Yesterday's News. And on the 3rd, John Land, A Date with Murder. He's taking over Jessica Fletcher, new character, Jessica Fletcher character, and it's really good. Alter Ego, Brian Friedman on the 7th. And a book that kids need to read about sexting and what happens when a young boy puts a photo on Instagram and everywhere else and gets arrested and sort of framed, Abuse and Discretion. On the 14th, we've got the author of Dead Air, What Happens When You're on a Radio Show and the Person That's Supposed to Be Doing It Is Dead. And we've got Nancy Allen, Wolf in the Woods, on the 17th. And that's just some of what I'm up to. So for those people that don't know, the last show I'm doing is on June 13th with Michael Shusko, and I'm going to be doing this show at 8 o'clock in the morning because he's in Japan. And then the next show will be August 1st. I'm taking the summer off. That's it, people. I will be reviewing books, but I will not be doing any interviews until August 1st. That's Fran's rule. So she goes and she wants to meet the president. Why does she bring Nicholas to meet the president? And how does he react to meeting the president of the United States?
Well, she brings him to meet the president for a couple of reasons. And first of all, since she has to go to the United States with Craig in order to finish running out the string on what they're investigating and join him when he meets with the president, she doesn't want to leave Nicholas by himself in France, in Paris. And so she wants to take Nicholas. And Nicholas has overheard conversations that his grandfather had with Emma that are very relevant to what's happening. And since Craig is anxious to get the president, the U.S. president, to intervene, he thinks that he will have a better chance of getting the president on board if the president can hear direct from Nicholas as to what those conversations were. So Craig's in favor then of bringing Nicholas, and Nicholas is very excited about meeting the president, which he does. And there's another element to this too. Although Elizabeth is the one who, of course, initially befriended Nicholas, and she and Nicholas have this bond and relationship, Craig has come to like the kid as well. I mean, he's smart, he's resourceful, he's fun to be with, and so Craig likes him as well. And Craig likes being with him. They play video games together, and the kid's terrific at video games, and he's beating Craig at some of these games. And so Craig develops his own fondness for Nicholas, and so the trip to Washington. Oh, and he takes Nicholas with him. They have a few hours a morning while Elizabeth's off doing something related to attending a memorial service for the grandfather of Nicholas. So she Craig takes them off to the Spy Museum, which is a terrific place in Washington, because Nicholas can't go to the memorial service because everybody thinks Nicholas is dead. Well, he isn't dead, of course. He's with Craig and Elizabeth. So they go off to the Spy Museum, which is a great site in Washington. They have a terrific time, and then they go and meet with the president. So Craig is forming his own bond, and of course, this is getting Craig and Elizabeth to start thinking about, hey, maybe we should get married. Maybe what about children? Hey, but then who's going to take care of Nicholas when this book is when this story is over? What's going to happen to Nicholas? And so that introduces a new layer of complexity into this story. So that's what's going on with this.
Yeah, well, they get kind of close to Nicholas, and I won't say what happens at the end, because you got me on that one. I said, like, wait a minute, okay, and yeah, so.
Well, that's right. I mean, they do, and we don't want to give away the story, but they do become close with Nicholas, and he's a terrific kid, and he's very important and pivotal to the story. And although it's a story, it's a thriller, and it's meant to have geopolitical issues, but at the end of the day, there's the relationship between Craig and Elizabeth. And I know a lot of your listeners are writers besides being readers. And so I have to say, you know, one of the things, and we've talked about this, Fran, on some of your other shows, as a writer of thrillers, you face the question early on, do I use the same characters in more than one book? Is it that an advantage or a disadvantage? This is my 14th novel, Russian Resurgence. And in my first six novels, I never repeated a character. But then when I did the Craig Page and Elizabeth Crowder in book seven, it really worked very, very well. And so I decided then to repeat them in a number of books, which is kind of interesting, and it's been fun. And Russian Resurgence is, of course, their newest one. But one of the things it is fun to do, but one of the things to keep in mind, it's also it's complicated because the characters' relationships have to develop and evolve from book to book. You can't keep them static because in real life, characters aren't static. And if the readers are attached to your characters, the readers want to see a development as well. And so in this book, I'm more personalizing Craig and Elizabeth by bringing in the whole element of the child and children, and their relationship continues to evolve in this book, and I hope that the readers will like the way in which it evolves, because I'm kind of happy with it. And I'm working on another Craig Page book, but I want to make sure that the readers like how they're evolving. I think that's important.
Well, I like Craig Page. So let everybody know one other thing. I don't know what made me do this. In March, I honored fantastic women authors. In May, and you were one of them. In April, you were one of them. Fantastic male authors. And next month, I've got a list of people that write books about real life incidents, people that write memoirs. And in June, I'm going to honor strong characters, male and female characters. So this way, people will get to know everybody's books and get to know, you know, Craig Page and other characters that they might not know, and start picking up more books to read. There was just, I don't know what made me do that. I just thought it would be cool, and everybody thought it was cool. So watch out in June, people. Strong characters. You just never know what I'm going to come up with. Yeah. So we've got Zabel and Kosoff, and they were targeted. So what happens when Craig warns them, you better watch out, something's going to happen? How come they just don't listen? They don't believe him.
Well, they don't believe him, that's right, because Craig doesn't. Craig's convinced he knows what's going on, and he does this at considerable risk to himself, and he doesn't believe, they don't believe that the threat is real, that the threat's there. He sees it coming, that the threat is to the Hungarian prime minister and to the Russian president. Craig sees that there's a threat that somebody wants to assassinate them, and he tries to get the U.S. president to try to block this assassination attempt. As we said before, the U.S. president won't act. He goes to the Hungarian prime minister, tries to get the Hungarian prime minister to act, and the Hungarian prime minister dismisses what Craig's saying. Now, in part, you can say, well, gee, here somebody comes in with a credible threat to the life of an important political figure. Why is that figure just blowing it off and not paying attention at all? And I think the answer to that, in part, is because sometimes world political figures like this, my Hungarian prime minister, probably like Orban in real life, have this great arrogance and hubris, and they think that nothing can happen to them, or they think that, hey, I have my own security. I don't need help from any outsiders, and I can do it myself. And so these are the factors that Craig runs up against. And so ultimately is Craig has to try, with Elizabeth's help, to thwart this assassination attempt on the Russian president and the Hungarian prime minister. And so it's kind of up to Craig. And you can say, well, wait a minute, if one of your listeners will say, well, gee, why does Craig want to do this? Why does he just let them end up getting killed? The answer is because Craig wants to, he has his own score to settle with their attempted assassin. And that's where the two threads of this story come together. Their attempted assassin is relevant to what happened to Craig's friend from the Israeli Mossad, who's murdered at the beginning of the book. So the two threads of the story very, very much come together. And Craig, in the last climactic scene, has to do battle one-on-one with this terrorist, and that kind of sets up the climax of the book.
Well, before we end, we have about 5 minutes, actually. At the end, we realize there are many unexpected twists and a surprise ending. So I'll say about that. So, are you bringing back the Russian president again?
Okay, here's what I'm doing is, in terms of writing plans, Russian Resurgence just came out. It's up on all electronic, Kindle, Nook, all those things. It's coming out of the printer this week, and we'll get to bookstores in about a week or two. I am now working. My next novel will not be a Craig Page book because it will involve my other character, Kelly Cameron, who's an FBI agent. I did the first book with her, Washington Power Play, that came out last year. People really like that. They want another Kelly Cameron book, so there will be another Kelly Cameron book. Then I'm going back to Craig Page and Elizabeth Crowder, but when I do, I will keep the Russian president in the story because he's too good a character. I don't want to let him get away. You know, I learned that long ago as a young writer. Never kill off your really good characters. It's much better to bring them back. So that's what I'm going to be doing with him.
Yeah, well, don't forget, we're going to do, and you're a part of it, we're going to do the panel on June 4th with several other authors, and we're going to talk about endings. Cliffhanger
endings.
Oh, I'm
really looking forward to that.
Yeah, I'm bringing characters back, but my question, this is a loaded question, is Craig and Elizabeth ever going to get married, or is he going to just say no all the time?
Well, I am wrestling with that in connection with the next Craig Page book. And I'm not being deceitful, putting you or your listeners off, but I haven't quite resolved that issue, but I think I've got a neat way to deal with it, but I'm afraid you're going to have to wait. It hasn't been fully resolved in my own mind. I'm wrestling with that. It's front and center for him. Believe me, it is. Absolutely. Thank you.
In my mind, it's got to make her innocent, you know, whatever. And before
right.
we go, tell everybody where we can get all of your books, since I've read every single one of them. Everybody should start from the beginning and read them all. And by the way, I have a nephew that just moved to Maryland, and my nephew is working in Washington, D.C. for a government agency.
Oh, okay. That's terrific. Well, this newest book, Russian Resurgence, is up right now on Kindle, Nook, all electronic things. It's going to be in bookstores in approximately 2 weeks, Barnes & Noble and elsewhere, so easy to get if the store doesn't have it ordered. The paper book will be up on Amazon. As far as my 13 other books, they are all up electronically on Kindle and Nook, and they are all available, at least from Amazon. And the newest books are in the bookstores as well, particularly Barnes & Noble stores. So they're easily available. But if you like one-click shopping, then Amazon, you can get them on Amazon or on BarnesandNoble.com. But at any rate, I really hope that readers, my website's www.alantopel.com. I would love to get feedback from any readers. I really, really appreciate that. So if you read it and want to comment, please let me know. Thank you very, very much. I appreciate it. If you want to put up a review on Amazon or whatever, I like reader interaction. Would love it. Fran, I'd love
talking
to you.
You're
going to
get mine later. It's not in paperback yet. It's just on electronic. It's not in paper yet.
Right. It'll be in paper in 2 weeks in bookstores. It's
okay.
Pre-order on Amazon, but it'll be in stores in 2 weeks. Absolutely. But it's available
okay.
electronically. And I'll look for your wonderful review on Amazon, and thank you so much.
You will be getting it later, but as soon as it comes out on paper, I have an uncle named Leonard that wants a copy of your book because he reads all your stuff, too. So that would be – I think you met him a few times. Okay, everybody.
Oh, yeah, I have.
Yes, he does. I sent him 3 books for his birthday, but I promised him I would send him yours. Otherwise, I'm still his favorite niece in the whole universe. That's what they told me. So I want to thank you so much. Everybody have a great day. The sun is shining. Have a great day, and bye.
Bye-bye, and many, many thanks, Brad. Really appreciate it. Take care. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.